Chapter 2. Sandstead House was an imposing building in the Georgian style. It stood four square in the midst of about 9 acres of land. For the greater part of its existence, I learned later, it had been the private home of a family of the name of Boone, and in its early days the estate had been considerable. But the progress of the years had brought changes to the Boones. Money losses had necessitated the sale of land. New roads had come into being, cutting off portions of the estate from their centre. New facilities for travel had drawn members of the family away from home. The old fixed life of the country had changed, and in the end the latest Boone had come to the conclusion that to keep up so large and expensive a house was not worth his while. That the place should have become a school was the natural process of evolution. It was too large for the ordinary purchaser, and the estate had been so whittled down in the course of time that it was inadequate for the wealthy. Colonel Boone had been glad to let it to Mr. Abney, and the school had started its career. It had all the necessary qualifications for a school. It was isolated. The village was 2 miles from its gates. It was near the sea. There were fields for cricket and football, and inside the house a number of rooms of every size, suitable for classrooms and dormitories. The household, when I arrived, consisted, besides Mr. Abney, myself, another master named Glossop, and the matron, of 24 boys, the butler, the cook, the odd-job man, 2 housemaids, a scullery maid, and a parlour maid. It was a little colony cut off from the outer world. With the exception of Mr. Abney and Glossop, a dismal man of nerves and mannerisms, the only person with whom I exchanged speech on my first evening was White, the butler. There are some men one likes at sight. White was one of them. Even for a butler, he was a man of remarkably smooth manners, but he lacked that quality of austere aloofness which I have noticed in other butlers. He helped me unpack my box, and we chatted during the process. He was a man of medium height, square and muscular, with some quality of springiness, as it were, that seemed unusual in a butler. From one or two things he said, I gathered that he'd travelled a good deal. Altogether, he interested me. He had humour, and the half hour which I had spent with Glossop made me set a premium on humour. I found that he, like myself, was a newcomer. His predecessor had left at short notice during the holidays, and he had secured the vacancy at about the same time that I was securing mine. We agreed that it was a pretty place. White, I gathered, regarded its isolation as a merit. He was not fond of village society. On the following morning, at 8 o'clock, my work began. My first day had the effect of entirely revolutionizing what ideas I possessed of the lot of the private school assistant master. My view, till then, had been that the assistant master had an easy time. I had only studied him from the outside. My opinion was based on observations made as a boy at my own private school, when masters were an enviable race who went to bed when they liked, had no preparation to do, and couldn't be caned. It seemed to me then that those three facts, especially the last, formed a pretty good basis on which to build up the perfect life. I had not been at Sandstead House 2 days before doubts began to creep in on this point. What the boy, observing the assistant master standing about in apparently magnificent idleness, does not realize is that the unfortunate is really putting in a spell of exceedingly hard work. He is taking duty. And taking duty is a thing to be remembered, especially by a man who, like myself, has lived a life of fatted ease, protected from all the minor annoyances of life by a substantial income. Sandstead House educated me. It startled me. It showed me 100 ways in which I had allowed myself to become soft and inefficient, without being aware of it. There may be other professions which call for a fiercer display of energy, but for the man with a private income who has loitered through life at his own pace, a little schoolmastering is brisk enough to be a wonderful tonic. I needed it, and I got it. It was almost as if Mr. Abney had realized intuitively how excellent the discipline of work was for my soul, for the kindly man allowed me to do not only my own, but most of his as well. I have talked with assistant masters since, and I have gathered from them that headmasters of private schools are divided into two classes, the workers and the runners up to London. Mr. Abney belonged to the latter class. Indeed, I doubt if a finer representative of the class could have been found in the length and breadth of southern England. London drew him like a magnet. After breakfast he would take me aside. The formula was always the same. Mr. Burns. Myself, apprehensively scenting disaster, like some wild creature caught within a trap, who sees the trapper coming through the wood. Yes? I'm afraid I shall be obliged to run up to London today. I have received an important letter from... And then he would name some parent, or some prospective parent. By prospective, I mean one who is thinking of sending his son to Sandstead House. You may have 20 children, but unless you send them to his school, a schoolmaster will refuse to dignify you with the name of parent. Then, he wishes, to see me, or in the case of titled parents, he wishes, to talk things over with me. The distinction is subtle, but he always made it, and presently the cab would roll away down the long drive, and my work would begin, and with it that soul discipline to which I have alluded. Taking duty means certain definite calls upon a man. He has to answer questions, break up fighting, stop big boys bullying small boys, prevent small boys bullying smaller boys, check stone-throwing, going on the wet grass, worrying the cook, teasing the dog, making too much noise, and in particular discourage all forms of harakiri, such as tree-climbing, water-spout-scaling, leaning too far out of the window, sliding down the banisters, pencil swallowing and ink drinking because somebody dared me to. At intervals throughout the day there are further feats to perform, carving the joint, helping the pudding, playing football, reading prayers, teaching, herding stragglers in for meals, and going round the dormitories to see that the lights are out, are a few of them. I wanted to oblige Cynthia if I could, but there were moments during the first day or so when I wondered how on earth I was going to snatch the necessary time to combine kidnapping with my other duties. Of all the learned professions, it seemed to me that that of the kidnapper most urgently demanded certain intervals for leisured thought, in which schemes and plots might be matured. Schools vary. Sandstead House belonged to the more difficult class. Mr. Abney's constant flittings did much to add to the burdens of his assistants, and his peculiar reverence for the aristocracy did even more. His endeavour to make Sandstead House a place where the delicately nurtured scions of the governing class might feel as little as possible a temporary loss of titled mothers led him into a benevolent tolerance which would have unsettled angels. Success or failure for an assistant master is, I consider, very much a matter of luck. My colleague Glossop had most of the qualities that make for success, but no luck. Properly backed up by Mr. Abney, he might have kept order. As it was, his classroom was a bear garden, and when he took duty, chaos reigned. I, on the other hand, had luck. For some reason, the boys agreed to accept me. Quite early in my sojourn, I enjoyed that sweetest triumph of the assistant master's life, the spectacle of one boy smacking another boy's head because the latter persisted in making a noise after I told him to stop. I doubt if a man can experience so keenly in any other way that thrill which comes from the knowledge that the populace is his friend. Political orators must have the same sort of feeling when their audience clamours for the ejection of a heckler. But it cannot be so keen. One is so helpless with boys, unless they decide that they like one. It was a week from the beginning of the term before I made the acquaintance of the little nugget. I had kept my eyes open for him from the beginning, and when I discovered that he was not at school, I had felt alarmed. Had Cynthia sent me down here to work as I'd never worked before, on a wild goose chase? Then one morning Mr. Abney drew me aside after breakfast. "Ah, Mr. Burns." It was the first time that I'd heard those soon-to-be-familiar words. "I fear I shall be compelled to run up to London today. I have an important appointment with the father of a boy who is coming to the school. He wishes, to see me." This might be the little nugget at last. I was right. During the interval before school, Augustus Beckford approached me. Lord Mountjoy's brother was a stolid boy with freckles. He had two claims to popular fame. He could hold his breath longer than any other boy in the school, and he always got hold of any piece of gossip first. "There's a new kid coming tonight, sir," he said. "An American kid. I heard him talking about it to the matron. The kid's name's Ford. I believe the kid's father's awfully rich. Would you like to be rich, sir? I wish I was rich. If I was rich, I'd buy all sorts of things. I believe I'm going to be rich when I grow up. I heard father talking to a lawyer about it. There's a new parlourmaid coming soon, sir. I heard cook telling Emily. I'm blowed if I'd like to be a parlourmaid, would you, sir? I'd much rather be a cook." He pondered the point for a moment. When he spoke again, it was to touch on a still more profound problem. "If you wanted a halfpenny to make up tuppence to buy a lizard, what would you do, sir?" He got it. Ogden Ford, the Eldorado of the kidnapping industry, entered Sandstead House at 9:15 that evening. He was preceded by a worried look, Mr. Arnold Abney, a cabman bearing a large box, and the odd job man carrying two suitcases. I have given precedence to the worried look, because it was a thing by itself. To say that Mr. Abney wore it would be to create a wrong impression. Mr. Abney simply followed in its wake. He was concealed behind it, much as Macbeth's army was concealed behind the woods of Dunsinane. I only caught a glimpse of Ogden as Mr. Abney showed him into his study. He seemed a self-possessed boy, very like, but, if anything, uglier than the portrait of him which I had seen at the Hotel Guelph. A moment later the door opened, and my employer came out. He appeared relieved at seeing me.
Mr. Burns, I was about to go in search of you. Can you spare me a moment? Let us go into the dining room. That is a boy called Ford, Mr. Burns, he said when he'd closed the door. A rather, remarkable boy. He is an American, the son of Mr. Elmer Ford. As he will be to a great extent in your charge, I should like to prepare you for his, peculiarities.
Is he peculiar? A faint spasm disturbed Mr. Abney's face. He applied a silk handkerchief to his forehead before he replied.
In many ways, judged by the standard of the lads who have passed through my hands, boys, of course, who, it is only fair to add, have enjoyed the advantages of a singularly refined home life, he may be said to be, somewhat peculiar. While I have no doubt that au fond, he is a charming boy, quite a charming, at present he is a, shall I say, peculiar. I am disposed to imagine that he has been, from childhood up, systematically indulged. There has been in his life, I suspect, little or no discipline. The result has been to make him curiously un-boy-like. There is a complete absence of that diffidence, that childish capacity for surprise, which I, for one, find so charming in our English boys. Little Ford appears to be completely blasé. He has tastes and ideas which are precocious and unusual in a boy of his age. He expresses himself in a curious manner sometimes. He seems to have little or no reverence for constituted authority.
He paused while he passed his handkerchief once more over his forehead.
Mr. Ford, the boy's father, who struck me as a man of great ability, a typical American merchant prince, was singularly frank with me about his domestic affairs, as they concerned his son. I cannot recall his exact words, but the gist of what he said was that until now Mrs. Ford had had sole charge of the boy's upbringing, and Mr. Ford was singularly outspoken, was too indulgent, in fact, spoilt him. Indeed, you will, of course, respect my confidence, that was the real reason for the divorce which has unhappily come about. Mr. Ford regards this school as in a measure, shall I say, an antidote. He wishes there to be no lack of wholesome discipline, so that I shall expect you, Mr. Burns, to check firmly, though of course kindly, such habits of his as cigarette smoking. On our journey down, he smoked incessantly. I found it impossible, without physical violence, to induce him to stop. But of course, now that he's actually at the school and subject to the discipline of the school... Exactly, I said. And that was all I wished to say. Perhaps it would be as well if you saw him now, Mr. Burns. You will find him in the study.
He drifted away, and I went to the study to introduce myself. A cloud of tobacco smoke rising above the back of an easy chair greeted me as I opened the door. Moving into the room, I perceived a pair of boots resting on the grate. I stepped to the right, and the remainder of the little nugget came into view. He was lying almost at full length in the chair, his eyes fixed in dreamy abstraction upon the ceiling. As I came towards him, he drew at the cigarette between his fingers, glanced at me, looked away again, and expelled another mouthful of smoke. He was not interested in me. Perhaps this indifference piqued me, and I saw him with prejudiced eyes. At any rate, he seemed to me a singularly unprepossessing youth. That portrait had flattered him. He had a stout body and a round, unwholesome face. His eyes were dull, and his mouth dropped discontentedly. He had the air of one who is surfeited with life. I am disposed to imagine, as Mr. Abney would have said, that my manner in addressing him was brisker and more incisive than Mr. Abney's own. I was irritated by his supercilious detachment. "Throw away that cigarette," I said. To my amazement, he did, promptly. I was beginning to wonder whether I had not been too abrupt. He gave me a curious sensation of being a man of my own age. When he produced a silver case from his pocket and opened it, I saw that the cigarette in the fender was a stump. I took the case from his hand and threw it onto a table. For the first time, he seemed really to notice my existence. "You've got a hell of a nerve," he said. He was certainly exhibiting his various gifts in rapid order. This, I took it, was what Mr. Abney had called expressing himself in a curious manner. "And don't swear," I said. We eyed each other narrowly for the space of some seconds. "Who are you?" he demanded. I introduced myself. "What do you want to come butting in for?"
"I am paid to butt in. It's the main duty of an assistant master."
"Oh, you're the assistant master, are you?"
"One of them. And in passing, it's a small technical point, you're supposed to call me Sir during these invigorating little chats of ours."
"Call you what? Up an alley."
"I beg your pardon."
"Fade away. Take a walk."
I gathered that he was meaning to convey that he had considered my proposition, but regretted his inability to entertain it.
"Didn't you call your tutors, sir, when you were at home?"
"Me?
Don't make me laugh. I got a cracked lip."
"I gather you haven't an overwhelming respect for those set in authority over you."
"If you mean my tutors, I should say nix."
"You use the plural. Had you a tutor before, Mr. Broster?"
He laughed. "Had I? Only about 10 million.
"Poor devils," I said.
"Who's swearing now?"
The point was well taken. I corrected myself. "Poor brutes. What happened to them? Did they commit suicide?
How they quit? And I don't blame them. I'm a pretty tough proposition. And you don't want to forget it."
He reached out for the cigarette case. I pocketed it.
"You make me tired," he said.
"The sensation's mutual."
"Do you think you can swell around stopping me doing things?"
"You've defined my job exactly."
"Yes, again. I know all about this joint. The hot air merchant was telling me about it on the train."
I took the allusion to be to Mr. Arnold Abney and thought it rather a happy one.
"He's the boss, and nobody but him is allowed to hit the fellows. If you tried it, you'd lose your job. And he ain't going to because the dad's paying double fees and he's scared stiff he'll lose me if there's any trouble."
"You seem to have a grasp of the position."
"Bet your life I have."
I looked at him as he sprawled in the chair. "You're a funny kid," I said. He stiffened, outraged. His little eyes gleamed.
"Say, it looks to me as if you wanted making a head shorter. You're a darn sight too fresh. Who do you think you are, anyway?"
"I'm your guardian angel," I replied. "I'm the fellow who's going to take you in hand and make you a little ray of sunshine about the home. I know your type backwards. I've been in America and studied it on its native asphalt. You super-fatted millionaire kids are all the same. If Dad doesn't jerk you into the office before you're out of knickerbockers, you just run to seed. You get to think you're the only thing on earth, and you go on thinking it till one day somebody comes along and shows you you're not, and then you get what's coming to you, good and hard." He began to speak, but I was on my favourite theme, one I'd studied and brooded upon since the evening when I'd received a certain letter at my club. "I knew a man," I said, "who started out just like you. He always had all the money he wanted, never worked, grew to think himself a sort of young prince. What happened?" He yawned. "I'm afraid I'm boring you," I said.
"Go on, enjoy yourself," said the little nugget.
"Well, it's a long story, so I'll spare you it, but the moral of it was that a boy who is going to have money needs to be taken in hand and taught sense while he's young." He stretched himself.
"You talk a lot. What do you reckon you're going to do?"
I eyed him thoughtfully. "Well, everything's got to have a beginning," I said. "What you seem to me to want most is exercise. I'll take you for a run every day. You won't know yourself at the end of a week."
"Say, if you think you're going to get me to run..."
"When I grab your little hand and start running, you'll find you'll soon be running too. And years hence, when you win the marathon at the Olympic Games, you'll come to me with tears in your eyes and you'll say, 'Ah, shish!'"
"I shouldn't wonder."
I looked at my watch. "Meanwhile, you'd better go to bed. It's past your proper time." He stared at me in open-eyed amazement.
"Bed?"
"Bed." He seemed more amused than annoyed.
"Say, what time do you think I usually go to bed?"
"I know what time you go here. 9 o'clock. As if to support my words, the door opened and Mrs. Atwell, the matron, entered.
"I think it's time you came to bed, Mr. Burns."
"Just what I was saying, Mrs. Atwell."
"You're crazy,"
observed the little nugget.
"Bed, nothing."
Mrs. Atwell looked at me despairingly. "I never saw such a boy." The whole machinery of the school was being held up by this legal infant. Any vacillation now, and authority would suffer a setback from which it would be hard put to it to recover. It seemed to me a situation that called for action. I bent down, scooped the little nugget out of his chair like an oyster, and made for the door. Outside he screamed incessantly. He kicked me in the stomach and then on the knee. He continued to scream. He screamed all the way upstairs. He was screaming when we reached his room. Half an hour later I sat in the study, smoking thoughtfully. Reports from the seat of war told of a sullen and probably only temporary acquiescence with fate on the part of the enemy. He was in bed and seemed to have made up his mind to submit to the position. An air of restrained jubilation prevailed among the elder members of the establishment. Mr. Abney was friendly, and Mrs. Atwell openly congratulatory. I was something like the hero of the hour. But was I jubilant? No, I was inclined to moodiness. Unforeseen difficulties had arisen in my path. Till now, I had regarded this kidnapping as something abstract. Personality had not entered into the matter. If I had had any picture in my mind's eye, it was of myself stealing away softly into the night with a docile child, his little hand laid trustfully in mine. From what I'd seen and heard of Ogden Ford in moments of emotion, it seemed to me that whoever wanted to kidnap him with any approach to stealth would need to use chloroform. Things were getting very complex.